listening to Truth To You Radio with Jono on truth2u.org. That's truth number two, letter u.org, where you can sign up for the weekly newsletter, and you can also keep up to date via iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. And g'day to Kimberly from Idaho, who wrote on Facebook in regards to Treasures from the Tanakh. She said, I'm so excited about this new series. Jono, you are answering my prayers by providing all these fantastic discussions of the word. Toda rabba. Thank you, Kimberly, for your encouragement. And of course, it is time for Treasures from the Tanakh with Torah teacher Ira Michelson. Welcome back, Ira.
Good day, Jono.
G'day, my friend. Boy, we're back in Job. Last time we left off, we really left Job in a really miserable, miserable place. And it's nice to know that we're at least going to be moving on from there. And we're going to be, because last week, boy, he was cursing the day that he was born all the way through chapter 3. Now we're in chapter 4 and one of his mates is going to speak up.
Right. But I mean, you know, come on, we want to kind of give the people some background from last week. You don't want to talk about the potsherds and ashes.
No, and the leprosy. No, it's okay. If they missed it, they can go back and they can listen to it there. It's there available for free download, my friends. By all means, do the research. But we're going to be kicking off from there, if that's okay.
All right.
In chapter 4, who is this guy?
Who is Eliphaz? So, you know, we want to talk about this for a little bit related to the names. We kind of talked about it briefly in the first show that we did in chapter 1. And we talked about who Job was. And we talked about the fact that he was this great man from the East. And we talked about the possibility that he could be one of the commentaries is that he could be Jobab, which I may go into a little bit here. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that they say that his name can mean, Eov, is where is my father, which is an interesting interpretation considering what he's going through. In other words, he's kind of got this mindset of where is God, and that's why he makes some of the statements that he makes. Eliphaz, on the other hand, means my God is fine gold.
Wow.
Yeah, it's amazing, that name. So although, as with all matters of poetic, we have to be on the alert for intentional hidden meanings that we see. Uh-huh. And so we see at the beginning of this speech that starts in Job chapter 4, verse 1 and 2, if you want to read the first couple of verses.
Well, it says, then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, now he's the first one to pipe up, right? So mm-hmm. They sat there for 7 days in the dust, in the ashes, in what potentially was the rubbish dump, as you pointed out last week.
Right.
And after 7 days of silence of his friends consoling him and being there for him, eventually Job pipes up in chapter 3 and curses the day that he is born. The first of his three friends that are sitting there with him speaks. This is Eliphaz, and this is what he says. Mm-hmm. If one attempts a word with you, will you become weary? But who can withhold himself from speaking?
Right. And so, you know, he kind of starts polite enough if we read it in the English. And he kind of makes it sound like he's recognizing the distraught state that his friend is in. And if we were talking in our language today, it might sound something like, would you mind if I spoke, or would you mind if I say something about your condition? Mm. But he kind of reveals his own impatience with Job's lament. And so I just want to go into it before I go into the question of who he is and so forth.
Sure.
Because it kind of, like I said, it reveals impatience with his lament. In other words, how can I respond to what you said? But when we look at it in Hebrew, it says, Hanisa davar elecha tile vatsor bimilin miyochal. And the hey there of Hanisa shows us that this is an interrogative and it's a question. And Nisa means to test or to try. And then we see this word of tile there comes from the Hebrew root la'a, which means to be weary, but it could also mean to be exhausted or impatient. Mm-hmm. So a translation from the Hebrew would sound something closer to, he tested you with one thing and you are wearied or exhausted or impatient, or you could say something like you were tested by this thing and you're weary or impatient or exhausted. And that sounds totally different.
I wondered about the first thing that I thought when I read verse 2, and again it says in my translation, if one attempts a word with you, will you become weary? It suggested to me, and I wasn't so sure about this as I read on, but when I first read it, I thought, I wonder if he knows what his agenda is. I wonder if he knows that he wants to convey something to Job that Job doesn't want to hear. I wonder if he's saying, look, if I'm blunt with you, are you going to roll your eyes? Is it are you going to listen to what I say? Are you going to be patient enough to accept what I say to you? Is that a possibility?
Yeah, it is a possibility. And I think what ends up happening is this is where we get into really starting to talk about the potential connection that there is between them. Because it would seem at this point that Eliphaz is kind of, in a sense can be seen like he's being insensitive. You know, he sat there for 7 days, he listened to everything that, you know, that Job had to say, and now it seems like here's this guy in intense anguish, and now he goes from being a friend, as I said last week, with friends like this who needs enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the kind of conduct that we see on the part of Eliphaz can be understood in light of the fact that they're connected by something other than mere friendship. And that's why I said this might be a good time to kind of explore that connection.
Sure.
Because one of the things that we see is in Genesis 36, we read about the generations of Esav, of Esau.
Mm-hmm.
And we learn that one of the sons of Esav is named Eliphaz. And so there are actually some Jewish commentators that believe that they're one and the same, that actually this Eliphaz that is the friend of Eov or the friend of Job or a contemporary of Job is actually the son of Esav. But even those who do not believe that he's the son of Esav don't doubt that that both Job and Eliphaz are both from Edom. And we read in Genesis 36, 31 to 33, it says, now these are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the sons of Israel. Bela, the son of Beor, reigned in Edom, and the name of his city was Dinhabah. And then it says, then Bela died, and Jobab, the son of Zerah of Basra, became king in his place. And this is where we introduce this possibility that Job is actually this king that we talked about and potentially could be this king Jobab.
Hmm.
Because we also see this in 1 Chronicles 1:44, the same kind of lineage. And then in verse 34, it says, then Jobab died, and Husham of the land of Temanites became king in his place. So we see this connection.
Can I just ask you,
absolutely.
Before we get to that connection,
sure.
How would you pronounce Jobab? Is that Eobab?
Yes. So we see this kind of connection there because we see two things. We see that this Jobab, the son of Zerah, is from Basra. And then we see in verse 34 that right after he dies, that another king takes his place, and he's of the Temanites, which we see is what Eliphaz is. He's a mm-hmm. Temanite. And so we also see this idea of Basra, and Basra is the capital of Edom. So when we make this connection, and we did make this connection related to the great men of the East, and the fact that Eliphaz and the others that came were from the East as well, and that the East was this place of great wisdom. And I think it's important to recognize that, because I think that we're going to see in chapter 4 and chapter 5 that Eliphaz is coming with this wisdom from the East to speak to Job. We see a verse in Obadiah, chapter 1, verse 8, that says, will I not on that day, declares Jehovah, destroy wise men from Edom and understanding from the mountain of Esav. And then in 1 Kings, chapter 4, verse 30 in the English, but chapter 5, verse 10 in the Hebrew Bible, it says, he, and this is related to Shlomo HaMelech, to King Solomon, he was wiser than all other men, and Solomon's wisdom was greater than all of the people of the East. So in other words, Solomon was
the benchmark. There's the benchmark, right?
So Solomon was the wisest of all men, even of the men of the East. And since this is meant to be complementary to Solomon, obviously the people of the East must have been extremely wise men. And this could also support the notion that we touched on, that you asked about, that potentially Solomon is actually the author of the book. Potentially. Yeah, potentially. I don't know. There's a lot of support for that. I don't know that I'm ready to, hang my hat on that, but there's strong support based on this wisdom, this idea of this being, there's a lot of wisdom going on here.
Indeed. And so that suggestion is not without argument, but so it goes on. Surely you have instructed many, he says to Job, and you have strengthened weak hands. Your words have upheld him who was stumbling, and you have strengthened the feeble knees, is what I've got. But right. Now it comes upon you.
Sure. So it's interesting that here we have these three guys that come, and Eliphaz speaks first. So in a sense, he can almost be seen as a sort of spokesman for the group, and maybe he's kind of the leader of the group. And
I've read some commentaries that suggest, and this is just speculation, that perhaps he was even the older of the group and therefore maybe the wiser because of his age and just had the right to speak first, perhaps.
Could be. We may see something that supports that notion later on. So we say, Hine yisata rabim v'yadim rafot tichazek. And so he says, behold, you have admonished or rebuked the many, and weak hands you have strengthened, as you said. And we see in Isaiah chapter 35, verse 3, almost word for word of what we see in verse 3 and verse 4 here, where Yehovah, through the prophet, calls for the people to have their hands strengthened and the weak knees made strong. We talk about that. And then in verse 4, as you said, it says, those who stumble you have caused to stand from your words, and knees that bow down you made strong. And that word, because we read in the Hebrew there, it says, Koshel yikimun milecha uvrichayim korot. Te'ametz. And so that word korot comes from kara, to bow down, and ametz, to be strong or to be bold. So what we're seeing here is that in those verses, Eliphaz is acknowledging Job's spiritual leadership in the past. In other words, he's saying the words used here indicate not a physical but a spiritual help. In other words, he was the guy that was when people had this kind of problem, he was the guy. Job was the one that was encouraging these people when they were going through trouble. And so he's the one that encouraged them. He's the one that he was the go-to guy in this situation.
He was the go-to guy. If only Job had a friend like Job, it would have been a different story altogether. But it goes on to say, Eliphaz says to him, but now it comes upon you, and you are weary. And it touches you, and you are troubled. Is not your reverence your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope?
Right. So very much what you read would be from the Hebrew, very true, for it now comes to you, and you are impatient. It touches you or strikes you, and you are dismayed. Very similar wording. So what has come to Job? Suffering. In other words, he's saying to him, you helped others in their distress, but now when you're afflicted, you're upset, and you want to die. And he's basically saying, why don't you listen to your own advice that you so freely gave to others?
Oh, that's a bit rough, though, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it is rough, but this is what he's saying. I mean,
because the really strength of a friend like Job to be able to offer words of encouragement and strength to those who are going through trouble is the fact that there is somebody else on your side who almost, I guess, as we've all experienced in the past, somehow you are... receiving their strength by the osmosis of their words, if you like, as you receive their words and you know that someone else is there with you and someone else believes in you and someone else is encouraging you, and you receive their strength and you find strength there. In this case,
Eliphaz is not that guy. He did his strength thing when he sat there in silence for 7 days.
Oh, man.
That's when he showed himself strong, by keeping his mouth shut.
Yeah, well, that's
for
the point.
7 days.
Yeah,
but it's interesting, as we were chatting before the show, that we're at a very interesting time in Judaism. We're in a time that's called Ben HaMetzarim, which means between the straits. It's the days from the 17th of Tammuz to Tish B'Av, the 9th of Av, which will be on this Sunday, depending on the calendar that you follow, whether or not you follow the rabbinic calendar or whether or not you follow the sighted moon. It might be a day off, but it's a time that's most associated with the suffering of the Jewish people, which makes it very interesting for our study. You know, this is a time when it's said that both temples were destroyed on the 9th of Av, that the Crusades against the Jewish people, and as the knights were marching to free Jerusalem from the Muslims, it's believed that World War I was started on the 9th of Av, and that started the pogroms in Russia, and that actually it was on the 7th of Av that the final solution was discussed about the Jews, and then it was on the 9th of Av that it was presented by Himmler to the Nazi Party, which would brought about the Holocaust. And so yet, while the Jewish people have become used to suffering, Eliphaz makes it sound like this is the first time that Job has experienced acute pain and loss. I mean, think about that.
Yeah. It's interesting, just on, before we move on from there, just on what you said, of course, the listeners are listening to this the weekend after the 9th of Av. So last weekend for the listeners, it was the 9th of Av. And last weekend, when Yoel and I were discussing in Judges chapters 10 to 12, and he mentioned, he pointed out that it's traditional for Yemenite Jews to, in fact, read through the book of Job during the, that time of the year as well, which is also interesting.
Yes.
But sorry, you were saying.
So I was saying that in essence, that going on from this idea of suffering, so it's kind of like, you know, we know as Jewish people, we're used to suffering. We see this all, you know, sometimes at our own, you know, by our own hand, you know, of course, by attaching ourselves to pagan, you know, pagan gods, pagan women, so forth and so on. But it would appear that, you know, that as we talked about Job in the first chapter, that here's a guy that like never suffered any kind of pain or loss. And so you would kind of think that the bitter response from Job in chapter two would be more fitting for someone who had kind of been worn out by extensive suffering, that you wouldn't kind of see this lament from someone who enjoyed a life of, you know, of luxury, so to speak. So I think what ends up happening is Eliphaz finds it difficult to hold back his words of rebuke at this time. You know, it's kind
and
of
yet, yeah. And yet he clearly has, as we will see, he has a message that he wants to convey. But in the way that I read it, and maybe it's, I don't know if it's different in the Hebrew, but in the way that I read it from the English, he seems to be very diplomatic in the way that he presents it, and he seems to be very almost subtle and gentle in the way that he lays it down. But he does make his point, and even though his point is harsh, but we're going to see that, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's harsher than it appears. English.
Really?
I think
in the Hebrew, it's harsher.
Yeah, I think there's some underlying, strong rebuke that's coming. It can seem pretty harsh here.
Remember now, whoever perished. Now, well, here it is. I mean, if this isn't an accusation, he says, remember now, whoever perished being innocent. Now, what's he saying there?
So just to touch on verse 6 before you move on there, where it says, is not your fear of God, because that fear there that's talking about your fear. Hello, Yevatcha, you know, is not your fear, your confidence, your hope, and the blamelessness of your ways. We see Vatom Derachecha, you know, from that same word, Tam, where he was called Ish Tam, a blameless man. We see that idea of blamelessness. What I think is really funny is that the third word in the verse, Kislatecha, which means your confidence, there can also mean stupidity or folly. So it kind of can be really interesting. And why I say that's interesting is because later on in chapter 4 and chapter 5, we're going to see this introduction of foolish. Eliphaz talks about the fool quite often and foolishness quite often in this. So I just wanted to touch on that really quickly. This also answers the argument that we can make in verse 26 of chapter 3 in this idea of, Job saying what I feared came upon me.
True.
Because this might be something that Job himself had once said that Eliphaz is now repeating to him.
Oh, good point. That's certainly a possibility.
Yeah. because we see this idea of this notion of the beginning of wisdom as the fear of the Lord. And so Eliphaz, in a sense, seems to think that, you know, Job has thrown away his fear of God by speaking honestly about his feelings.
Possibly.
Yeah, it's very possible. Yeah. So then in verse 7, as you said, we see Zecharna, remember now, who being innocent, and that word innocent there can also be clean or free, mm-hmm. who being innocent has ever been destroyed, and where are the upright, Yisharim, where are the upright? And this is where it gets interesting, because this word Nichadu, which often is translated destroyed, actually can mean to be blotted out or erased. And I think that's very interesting.
That's what I've got. I've got cut off. So remember now, whoever perished being innocent, or where were the upright ever cut off?
Yeah, and actually one of the translations uses the English word effaced, you know, and effaced could actually mean blotted out or erased. And I think that's very interesting, mm-hmm. because this is where the Jewish concept of blotting out or being erased comes in, where mm-hmm. There is no concept of this eternal judgment. You know, we talked about this idea of hell last week, you know, as you did with Yoel as well. There is no concept of eternal judgment in Judaism. What you see in Judaism is just this kind of thing where the wicked are blotted out or erased. In other words, a soul just ceases to exist, rather mm-hmm. than the souls that would have their inheritance in the Olam Haba, in the world to come.
Mm-hmm. But here is he making an accusation in the form of a question? Saying you are done for, you're likely going to die by the look of you, and yet who has ever perished being innocent? In other words, you're not innocent. Look at you. Clearly, you're not innocent. Is that the subtle suggestion here?
Yeah, it's a subtle suggestion there, and you know, in a sense, Eliphaz could be challenging him as well. Go ahead, bring me a list of those who are innocent, or that have been upright, that you've seen punished in the way you're being punished now.
Mm.
You know, who show me.
That's what I think he's doing.
Yeah.
And then he goes on to say, even as I have seen those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. By the blast of God they perish, and by the breath of his anger they are consumed.
Right. So it would read in the Hebrew, it says from the breath of Eloah. And Eloah is the singular of Elohim. You know, it's one of those poetic names for God. And it says, from the breath of Eloah, they are destroyed. And by the wind or the spirit of his anger, they come to an end or are finished completely. And that anger, I think it's always interesting to bring this kind of this image to people. Mm. Oftentimes when you see that idea of anger, like we see in verse 9, the Hebrew word is for nose.
Ah, right, that's right. So the idea of the flaring up of the front of the face in anger, the redness. Yeah,
it's exactly that flaring of the nostrils. And I always use the image of, you know, when I was a kid and we would watch cartoons, you know, we see the kind of matador in the bull ring. And that bull would start flaring his nostrils and smoke. Smoke would come out of the bull's nostrils before he would attack. And this is the image that I get in my head when I think about the anger of Jehovah, that in essence his nostrils are flaring and smoke is coming out of his nostrils. That's how angry he is. It's really...
That is graphic. And actually, speaking of graphic, verse 10, the roaring of the lion, the voice of the fierce lion, and the teeth of the young lions are broken. The old lion perishes for lack of prey, and the cubs of the lioness are scattered. Is Eliphaz comparing Job to an old lion that's sort of come to the end of his? What's the analogy here?
Well, there is that possibility. What I find really interesting is that there's almost every in these verses, there's almost every word for lion in the Hebrew used in these verses. You know, it says the roaring of a lion, Ariyeh, and the voice of a fierce lion, Shachal, and the teeth of the Kifirim, you know. I think it's interesting that it translated young lions. Actually, in the Septuagint, they translated as dragons. I don't know why. But there's an interesting verse in Hosea Hosea 5, verse 14. Mm-hmm. And this is Yehovah. He says, Ki anochi kishachal le'efraim v'chachper le'beit Yehuda ani etrof ve'elech esa ve'en matzil. And it says there, because I will be like a shachal, I will be like a lion to Ephraim and like a fierce lion, kifir, or a beast to the house of Judah. I myself will tear and walk away. I will carry what cannot be rescued. In other words, this idea of tearing the prey. And so shachal, when we see that word shachal, it's related to hunting. That lion that hunts, and then we see Aryeh, which is the typical word that we see for lion. You notice a lot of Israelis that name their children Ari, and Ari means lion. And Kifarim translated typically young lion. And then in verse 11, we see Laish, which is actually a lioness. I'm sorry, not Laish. Laish is another word for lion that perishes from lack of prey. And the sons of a Levi, of a lioness, are separated.
Uh-huh.
And so we get into some tricky verses here when it relates to translation. That's why I said possibility. So I want to look at both possibilities, you know. And sometimes we can't be certain of the meaning of words, but at least we can try.
Mm-hmm.
And so of the many words I said, commonly translated lion, some most likely refer to other can refer to other aggressive species or species that may now be extinct, like we saw Leviathan. We saw that, you know, Pelosaurus. And I think there can be a twofold understanding of this, that even the greatest of beasts can be brought low, is what's being said here. And mm-hmm. so we have righteous Job, you know, who's the greatest man of the East, and Eliphaz trying to compare him to these great beasts.
Mm.
In other words, he's kind of figuratively describing how the wicked perish. And just as you said, when the old lion loses its teeth, it perishes quickly because it can't tear at its prey.
Mm. Mm.
And in the same way that he's making the argument that the wicked are punished with speed and intensity. And this idea of the lioness in verse 11 when it says Laish oved mivli taref uvne lavi yitpardu, it's this idea that the lion perishes from lack of prey, and the sons of the lioness, they are separated or divided.
Mm.
And so this kind of alludes to the wicked being separated from everything that they have, as has Job. In a sense,
he's comparing that. I guess that kind of comes back to verse 7, where he says, "Or where the upright were cut off." It seems like the
yes.
Yeah. So that's interesting. That's the way that I kind of understood it, is that he's comparing him with, you were once an incredible roaring lion, you know, the king of the jungle, if you like. You were a king, and but now you've been brought low, and this is what happens. And now this is interesting. I may be understanding this incorrectly, but what I understood, Ira, from verse 12 on, my ears, in a sense, pricked up when I read this, because to back up what he's saying, he resorts to a sort of a dream or a vision or a secret thing that was revealed to him. And you would know that in the tradition that I came from, there was a lot of that, you know. In that case, in the tradition where I came from, it was for lack of knowledge of the word that people would resort to dreams and, well, you know, I know that this is, you know, I had a dream and this happened, or a spirit came and whispered in my ear and said to me such and such, and they base everything on that. And here I thought, it's interesting, he's resorting now to a dream to back up what he's saying, or so it appears.
Yeah, so let me tell you about that. Let me tell you about my experience with that. You know, before I got married years ago, I lived with two other guys. We shared an apartment, and this one guy that I lived with, literally, no joke, would sleep with a pad and pencil. He would pray before he went to sleep and ask Yehovah to give him a dream.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not unusual for me to get up in the morning to go to work to see him sitting in front of the computer typing up the dream and the interpretation of the dream that that God had given him. And so I'm not big on dreams.
yeah, it really, Yeah, and my let's just say my experience of that is also somewhat negative. When people read into things and listen for what they want to hear, and then they insist on offering that information to you, it can be wearisome after a while. In any case, something similar happens to Eliphaz, or so he claims. It says, "Now a word was secretly brought to me, and my ear received a whisper of it in disquieting thoughts from the visions of the night. When deep sleep falls on men, fear came upon me and trembling, which made all my bones shake. Then a spirit passed before my face, and the hair on my body stood up. It stood still, but I could not quite discern its appearance. A form was before my eyes, and there was silence. Then I heard a voice saying, 'Can a mortal be more righteous than God? Can a man be more pure than his Maker? If he puts no trust in his servants, if he charges his angels with error, how much more who dwell in houses of clay, whose foundation is in the dust, who are crushed before a moth?'" Oh, my goodness. There's a lot in there. How do we piece that all together?
Well, I mean, so here's the thing. We have to determine whether or not this could potentially be a prophetic instance that's going on here for him. We say a dream, but you know, this could be a prophetic instance. We have situations where prophets thought that they were dreaming, and yet we see that he sees a form or an appearance that he can't quite make out. Some people, you know, try to determine whether or not this is just a ghost story. Because look, he's encountered or met dread and trembling, it says, and the abundance of my bones were filled with dread. In other words, his bones were quaking with fright in verse 14 is what it says.
It has to be asked, is he insinuating something here? Is he saying to Job, you thought that you were so... I mean, is he not possibly suggesting to him that, as it says in Proverbs, that pride comes before a fall? Is it possibly, right. Is that what he might be saying? Or is he, in fact, building upon or introducing an idea that we see that God presents to Job later on in the book, where he says, hey, where were you? Where were you when I created all of this? Right. Can you do any of this? What do you know about this stuff?
Right. Well, it's important to note that when we get to verse 17, that what Eliphaz is saying, that these are not his words. What he's saying in these verses that you read from 17 mm-hmm. on is the words come from this figure. Mm. You know, can man be more righteous than Eloah if from his Maker is a man more pure? And I'll paraphrase, you know, this is the IMV, the Ira Michelson version.
Sure.
I would say it like this: since man cannot have greater knowledge than his Creator, how is it possible for him to be the judge of Jehovah?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then we read this fact that he's saying that this being that he sees, this appearance that he sees, and this likens back to what we talked about in the first two chapters of these Malachim. Of these messengers, these B'nei HaElohim, these sons of God that appeared before God mm-hmm. in the divine court of the divine council, here's this messenger, because I think when it says in verse 18, hen ba'avadav lo ya'amin uv malachav yasim tahala. He says, behold, if in his servants he cannot trust, and in his messengers place error. So we see that idea of avad, which is a servant, mm-hmm. and we see that malach, uv malachav, and his messengers, this is referring to angels here. So he's saying if he can't trust in them, indeed how those who dwell in houses of clay, whose foundation is in the dust, who are crushed before the moth. You know, when we see this idea of clay and dust in verse 19, mm-hmm. this can actually be an allusion to the creation of man that we see in Bereishit chapter 2, verse 7, because it talked that he was formed from afar, the same word, afar, dust, that we see in verse 19. And it really speaks to the inherent mortality of, you know, our physical bodies. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you've ever had a moth, If anybody's ever tried to catch a moth, you realize how delicate their wings are. Their wings almost like fall apart in your fingers.
Well, they're covered in a film of dust, a particular type of dust, too, that enables them to fly. It's incredible, incredible creatures.
Right, exactly. So if a moth is so easily crushed in one's hand, how much more a human life? Mm. And we kind of and look, we see this in our world. We see kind of a cruel disregard for human life in our own world even today. Mm. And basically, this messenger recounts, if God does not trust his eternal malachim, his eternal angels, how much less is he going to trust those who are made of clay, whose lives are so easily snuffed out?
And so it goes on to say, they are broken in pieces from morning till evening. They perish forever with no one regarding. Does not their own excellence go away? They die, even without wisdom. Now, let me ask you something about that. I've got verse 21. Does not their own excellence go away? What do you have in the Hebrew?
In the Hebrew, it says, "Halo nisa yitram bam yamutu velo bechachma." So it's saying, is not their cord pulled up within them?
Uh-huh.
They die and not with wisdom.
Is he making a suggestion in the way that his children were killed?
Absolutely.
There it is.
He's saying basically that your tent cord, the tent cord is pulled up within them. They die and not with wisdom. So I think he's making a dual statement there, and we're going to see that all throughout this book. There's a dual statement being made there. He's reminding him of what happened, but he's also saying he's comparing our lives to tents. That are only temporary, and that the pulling up of one's tent cord is symbolic of death here.
Now, would you let me remind everyone the verse in Job 1:18 and 19, I believe it is. It says, while he was still speaking, another also came and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and suddenly a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they are dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you. And that's when Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head, and he fell on the ground and worshipped. And could it be said that this is what some might refer to verse 21? Is this a cheap shot from Eliphaz?
Well, I don't know that it's a cheap shot, because he's attributing it not to himself. He's attributing it to this angelic visitor. But I think he's quoting it to put Job in his place. In essence, what he's saying is, are you so foolish that you're going to maintain your innocence before God?
Mm.
And this is where we get into this idea of foolishness. You know, as we move forward into chapter 5, we start to deal with this concept of foolishness, and that he talks to him at the end. Even if the eternal angels are impure in God's sight, how can mortal man be pure? How can you claim to be innocent before God?
Before we even consider chapter 5, I mean, before we started, I was very ambitious and I thought we'd get to the end of chapter 5. Clearly, we're not going to do that. But
okay.
But what I it just occurred to me now, is it a possibility that the reaction of Eliphaz, and as we see, it carries on to his other two friends as well, the way that they respond to Job has been motivated by the adversary who has been commissioned by Yehovah. Is it possible then that the figure that came and whispered in Eliphaz's ear and said all these things, is it possible that it was the adversary who came to plant in Eliphaz's ear these ideas, so that when he came to Job, that Job would find no comfort in his friends?
Look, if we know from the very beginning that the role of the adversary is to test, and specifically in this instance, that he was, his main role was to see Job curse God.
Mm.
We've already seen this with the wife, where the wife comes and the wife says, why don't you just curse God and die? And we touched on that, and we touched on the idea that, of course, this was HaSatan's desire, is to see him curse God. So first we see this instance of the wife. Now it certainly makes sense that when we see this angelic being, Nana, because I don't think it was a ghost story. I think he had an angelic visitation. So, of course, if we know that the role of Satan in this case is to test him and to see him curse God, that it would make absolute sense that this is who visited Eliphaz, and this is the rebuke that he's bringing forth.
And so the rebuke that he's bringing forth may well have come from either he imagines that he had some sort of visitation, and he is relating to Job what he understood of that visitation, or in fact he did have a visitation, and it would make sense then that it was the adversary, and the adversary planted into his ear the words that would not offer relief or comfort or encouragement to Job. And that's fair, because as we spoke about when we were doing chapter one, I think it was the story of Micaiah at the end of Kings, the prophet Micaiah. The prophet Micaiah hears that a spirit says to Yehovah, "I will go forth and be a lying spirit." And Yehovah says, "Ah, great idea. You'll succeed. Off you go." So it's possible. It's possible.
Right. However, I think it's important to note that if this is in fact a visitation, then we could make the argument that it is Satan. But if he's having a dream, I don't believe, you know, I don't believe that this would have been a visitation from the adversary himself, because I don't think that he would have that ability.
Very interesting. We have been doing Treasures from the Tanakh with Torah teacher Ira Michelson, and thank you, my friend, for coming back on to Truth to You. And of course, next week we will be continuing with Eliphaz, because in chapter 5, my little subheading says Eliphaz says Job is chastened by God. We'll see exactly what he has to say, and there's a few other things that we want to touch on in that chapter. And I look forward to speaking with you again next week, my friend.
Looking forward to it.
Thank you for your time. And until then, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.